Yeah, hello. It's a great pleasure to come here. Thanks a lot for the kind invitation to this great place. It's actually really nice. I haven't ever been here before, so I'm really surprised how what great place that is. And I guess it's also a very good environment for discussion. And I'm very much looking forward to discuss with all of you in the next days I'm here. So I just started recently a new team about 1.5 years ago, and we had to start from scratch a new apparatus and new ideas. And I will tell you a little bit about the ideas that we have and that we are working on, because it might be interesting also for theorists to know what is coming up in experiments or what I think we can do soon. This is on the line of optical access that you can address these quantum gases with high resolution and so on, and I will mostly talk about that a little bit. And I will also talk about a few ideas where we use Raman beams to create states with angular momentum. Yeah, so I will have a very short introduction on quantum simulation and general, and why that is interesting, but I will keep that very short, of course, with this audience. So why do we want to do this quantum simulation? Well, recently the opportunity has emerged where we can now really study these condensed matter models with so-called atom experiments that are otherwise very hard to study experimentally, of course, because there is, of course, a big gap between the experiments in condensed matter physics and the models that are created to try to understand the essence of the physics that's happening there. But now we can really start studying that with ultra-cold atoms, and HTC, of course, is a big thing there. One important goal in this community is to realize the positive U-Hubbert model with ultra-cold fermions. That's also one of the things we plan in the future in our experiments. And there are, of course, a lot of open questions whether you can have pairing, for example, with only repulsive interactions, and so it is hoped that we can see D-wave superconducting or superfluid states in such systems. And let me actually skip this introduction. Another interesting area is quantum magnetism, where where it is expected that you can create quantum states with frustrations. Like, for example, if you have exchange interaction, then it is often not trivial what the ground state of a given system is, and the reason for that can be, gosh, how do you switch that up?
Eugene is not doing his work.
And the reason for that can be either a geometrical situations like in Kagame lattices or so on, where it is clear that one spin would be up, the other spin would be down, but the third one is unclear. And then there are different terms that compete essentially and will describe what ground state you have. Or you can also get the same with long wedge interaction instead. Okay, anyways, so on the experimental side, what do we need to realize systems like that? What are experimenters working on right now? First of all, we are working on bosonic systems and fermionic systems, and there are many experiments with different species now, because it makes a difference often how the interaction properties work out and so on. And so what do we need to get more quantitative, more reliable quantum simulations, and to simulate more complex systems on the line of these quantum magnetism and so on?
Could I already ask a question?
Yeah, go ahead.
When you are mentioning the word quantum simulation, what exactly do you mean? Do you mean identifying different phases? Do you mean getting the phase boundary? Do you mean getting the whole phase diagram? These are all separate issues. For example, identifying just the phases is relatively easy. Getting phase boundary is much more difficult, and getting the whole phase diagram is much more difficult. Are you talking about all of these, or what do you mean?
I guess in general, experiments should be possible in all of these different regimes. Of course, one would start with simple things, but it depends a lot also on how you can probe your system, how much information you get out. For example, things like if you have an inhomogeneous system, but you cannot resolve individual regimes in that inhomogeneous system, then you can only tell that there is a phase transition, but you can't like really map out the scaling or it might be hard to get more quantitative information, but experimenters are also working on experiments, or like we have also work on experiments, for example, where you can with optical access or with having more homogeneous systems, you can also get more quantitative information. So it's really a process of development. I mean, in general, I guess quantum simulation is a system where you, it's not necessarily constrained to.
I'm going to place this point slightly. So if you look at the Bose-Hubbard model,
yeah.
Something you pioneered experimentally, and Peter, who's sitting behind me, theoretically, was originally started 7-8 years ago.
Yeah.
And it's a completely well-understood model theoretically. There is no controversy about what the phase diagram is. And still, you don't really have a phase diagram coming out of this kind of quantum simulation.
Yeah.
You know the phases. Now you're talking about models where there is great theoretical controversy about what the phase diagram is.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So
I will come back to that problem. Like as I said, that is a lot linked to current experimental limitations, essentially. Like, for example, you have an inhomogeneous system, but you always average over the entire system. But that limitation is absolutely not fundamental, but it is common in all different experiments right now. So if you solve that problem, and for example, you can have an inhomogeneous system where you can now resolve areas with a different chemical potential, or you have a box-like potential, for example, then you can suddenly map out a phase diagram versus chemical potential, let's say, like in the Mott-Hubbard model where you get lobes and so on. And but that would then not only apply for the simple Bose-Hubbard model, that could also apply to other experiments. So I really don't see a fundamental limitation there.
Can I ask the same question from
yes.
a different point of view? So when you use the word simulation, are you simulating the result of a theoretical calculation, or do you propose to simulate another physical system?
I mean, I guess it, how you define that probably depends from where you come, essentially from which direction you come. But it's mostly usually a simulation you would call something if you essentially if you know the Hamiltonian, but you cannot.
The key problem in solid state physics is that you don't know the Hamiltonian.
That is one of the key problems, but I guess. Theoretical physics, right.
Sometimes you know the Hamiltonian, but you don't know.
Right. I mean, you not only don't know the Hamiltonian, but you have many ideas what the Hamiltonian, like which kind of Hamiltonian could describe the essence of the physics that you're observing in a much more complicated. I mean, I don't want to simulate complete, let's say, high TC superconductors. So I don't want to exactly rebuild that with alpha cold atoms and then exactly realize that Hamiltonian. Instead, the idea is really to study the more fundamental, the more simple Hamiltonians that can be realized in a very clean form now, and that you can study those. So in that context, yeah, you could argue you are simulating something that only exists in theory, but really what you in a longer term, that should lead to you can enhance the complexity, of course. So, one thing where experimenters are working on is to, or what is needed for more complex quantum simulation is different geometries. One example would be Kagame lattices, for example. Most experiments so far have been done in simple cubic lattices, which are fairly easy to realize, but a lot of interesting physics would emerge if you could make lattices like these, for example, as proposed by Louis
Ask a question about the physical stability of this triangular kind of form Kagome disconnect.
So for a lot of the physics, one challenge is that you have to fairly small energy scales. If you have if you need exchange interaction to create certain quantum states, then naturally your energy scale with which you have to know your potential is an order j square over u, for example. And so it is actually important that you create potential with a very good stability, and very that you really know your potential very well, and that you can have it stable and things like that. And that is a real challenge, but there are but often, I mean, what is nice usually about these optical potentials is, and we've seen that in the simple cubic lattices, they only have pairs of beams, for example, that they can be very clean and very stable, and in principle, there shouldn't be. It should be absolutely possible to extend that to more complex lattice geometries. But that is exactly a challenge for people are working on right now. How good can you make other kind of lattice potentials, for example? And one interesting work, Emanuel Bloch has recently given a talk here also about double well potentials, where you can now realize he can realize exchange interaction in these double wells, which can also be which could turn out to be a very important ingredient for these to study quantum magnetism essentially in these systems. And then, of course, you can do spin-dependent lattice potential. And recently, very interesting work also with exchange interaction has been seen by Trey Porto and Bill Phillips and so on. They have used that to start doing very interesting physics in that regime. And then, of course, you have many new ingredients, and people will build a toolbox. What you, for example, can also do, and I guess soon we will actually see a couple of experiments with disorder, where you can use speckle pattern, for example, to create disorder and super lattices, or where you can also make a geometry with no harmonic confinement. But instead, you could imagine having a system where you have a box-like confinement, and so it's not as inhomogeneous anymore. And one has to see how far one gets in those experiments.
Can I ask you, what physical situation corresponds to spin-dependent lattice potential?
If you have a spin degree of freedom, and for example, a system with two spin states, you can create potentials. There are quite a few applications for that. The one application, for example, was proposed also by Michel Lukin and Peter Zoller and coworkers, where you have, you could imagine, for example, if you have two spin states and you trap them in two potentials that are interlaced, for example, like this, then having an atom in one lattice, all the atoms in one spin state would then sit in one lattice sides, all the atoms in the other spin state would sit in between the other atoms. And what you could now imagine is that the interaction between the atoms with the different spin states, for example, could create an effective next neighbor interaction, or you can also see that as phonon mediated interaction, essentially. That's one class of simple applications. But then you also have the things like in Troy Porter's experiment, where they have a double well. It's not a lentis so far, but it's an array of double wells. And by using internal degrees of freedom and changing the spin state, the spin-dependent optical lattices in time, they have now seen exchange interaction in these systems, essentially.
The question was, how do you actually make the spin-dependent lattices?
Mm-hmm. So
physically,
how you can make it is, like, normally with optical lattices, you work in a regime where the frequency of the laser light is very far detuned with respect to the atomic transition, and if the detuning is much larger than the splittings within the atom, like hyperfine splitting and so on, then the polarization wouldn't matter. But if you actually go a bit closer to resonance, or if you only are looking for a small difference, then the polarization of the light will affect the different spin states in a different way, essentially. Like, you have the polarization degree of freedom. And for example, we have to make experiments with this, where we have essentially two lattices for the two spin states, and we can shift the two lattices with respect to each other pretty much independently, essentially. And with that, it is possible to create this was essentially the reason why Peter Zoller and co-workers have had originally proposed the mod-insulator, to make this experiment in quantum information, where you start, for example, if you assume starting with two atoms on two neighboring lattice sites, and you move the optical lattice potentials, then they only come together on a single side if they are in opposite spin, and then they interact, and you get a phase gate, essentially. But okay, and then interaction, of course, is an important topic. We have Feshbach.
Can I ask a question about the previous one? I'm not sure if you want to say more about these things. The last item was the flat bottom trap. So can you evaluate and sort of briefly comment what the ideas are to make a box confinement?
Yeah, let me come back to that later, actually. I think I should do this short. I just wanted to give a brief introduction about what kind of tools are developed currently. I will come back later to that. In terms of interaction, of course, you have the normal particle-particle interaction that you can enhance by Feshbach resonances, but then people are also working on dipolar interaction, and one has to see how that works out. The best would be with polar molecules. Phonon-mediated interaction would be great. It's not clear yet how strong that can be. But what is very important, and recently the experiments of Emmanuel Bloch and Trey Porter are really making me very optimistic that the exchange interaction can be efficiently used in these experiments for quantum magnetism. Well, if you think about these are the ideas, if you have, for example, atoms in an optical lattice, and then you have a different atomic species, like you emerge this lattice in a Bose-Einstein condensate of a different atomic species. And then if you have an atom on a lattice side, it would displace the condensate of the other species in that area, essentially, and atoms on neighboring lattice sites could still feel that, essentially, and that is equivalent to creating a phonon in the BEC, and that then couples to other,
phonon.
Yeah, for example.
your phone answer due to interaction between atoms? What do you mean?
Or yeah, in a different, it's a phonon in a different PEC, for example. If you have a bath, if you have atoms in an optical lattice and the atoms are in one, are of one species, and then you have that emerged in the Bose-Einstein condensate of a different species, and you have interaction between the two species, then
no,
placing
no acoustic modes here
in the
in the lattice.
Not in the lattice, but the phonon would be in the other Bose-Einstein condensate, for example, and would couple, could then mediate interaction, things like that. Okay, and cooling, of course, will be very important. I'll skip this for now. Detection is very important, and recently a lot of new techniques have been realized, proposed by Klugin and co-workers also, for example, where you can really look at the atomic shot noise. And for example, we have seen experiments where you can see if you have a molecule and we dissociate the molecule or generalized Cooper pair, you can really see these correlations in the shot noise. If you take it, a picture in time of flight, essentially, we can see these correlations. And Emanuel Bloch and Mainz, they have done experiments where they look, for example, in a mod insulator, and then in the shot noise, you can still find correlations and also anti-correlations if you have fermions. And this would be a very powerful probe. For example, if you have realized an anti-ferromagnetic state, then you would get additional peaks here in between. And that would be a very sensitive and powerful probe to probe states like anti-ferromagnetism and so on. Now, but there's one shortcoming so far, like in all of the experimental systems, you're very limited in terms of how much you can really access your quantum gas with the spatial resolution. There have been some experiments where you have a very moderate spatial resolutions, like in dense damper current group, where they have a 2D gas and see structures on order of 5 micron or so, and in France also. But there's no experiment where you have an optical lattice in a regime where it is useful for many body physics, and you still have an optical resolution that is on the order of a lattice side. There are some experiments in that direction. For example, Device has built a nice system where he can, with a very high fidelity, measure whether there is an atom on a lattice side or not, by holding the atoms in an optical lattice and doing fluorescent imaging. The problem with that, however, is that his lattice spacing has to be very large, on the order of 5 micron. And of course, you would not have any tunnel coupling in between these lattice sides anymore. And it's a very classical situation, essentially. And ideas to overcome that come from NIST, for example, where they want to make a lattice that has a very small spacing initially, and then only for probing, they would increase the lattice spacing by a factor of 5 or 10, and then image. But that turns out to be very hard and difficult also. There are some recent experiments, like in Mainz, Hevig Ott, he's actually combining an electron microscope with an alpha cold atom experiment. And the idea is there, it's a scanning microscope, and he might be able to ionize atoms with the electron beam, and then you could detect the atoms or the electrons that fly out. It's not clear yet how powerful that will be, but that is also a very interesting idea.
Would this allow one to see actually different spin states also, or is it simply?
I don't think so. I think the I can't think about a way how you could, right? I mean, I think if you have an electron beam, my understanding, if you have an electron beam that would ionize an atom, my understanding is the spin state, the internal state wouldn't matter. Actually, maybe you can do tricks. Maybe you can I don't know, maybe if you excite atoms optically into an excited state, and then the electron beam is only harmful enough to do the last step of the ionization or something like that. And that might actually be, that's an interesting question. I don't know whether that's...
Well, this method sounds like extremely destructive.
Oh, yeah, it's totally destructive.
Energy scales.
Yeah. I mean, it depends. We'll see. It actually depends what you want to do. Well, it can be destructive if you do ionization. It can actually be also interesting. It can just create a very localized magnetic field and maybe not be very destructive. So I think they have some ideas on that line, but I don't know at all. It's not published at all. I've only heard rumor.
Is only like 50 nanometers for these electron beams that you make?
That could be very small, I think, yeah. But I don't know what their actual beam is like, yeah. But it's an interesting idea, definitely. I think they wanted to do two things. One is interaction of their like local magnetic field or so, and other ideas are to ionize atoms.
But the local magnetic field, you mean that you make a circle with your beam and then generate?
Let me think. I think it's a current, right? And so you have you should have field lines around that arise pretty quickly, if I understand that correct. I guess it's like a very thin wire, right? And I don't know. I mean, but on the other hand, would this be a very strong? I guess currents are fairly small usually in such a beam, if the beam is small, but could be interesting, because of course it scales. If you're close to the wire, it scales very, very well. Okay. But all these other optical systems are very limited, essentially, and with those it wouldn't be possible to make a lattice way, which is still useful to study many body physics, but you can still optically address that. And that is why we came up with an idea that would allow us to do so, and I would like to tell you a little bit about that. So if you have a normal BEC in a lattice, for example, then normally the optical resolution is much smaller than the lattice spacing. What happens is that you make the lattice with counterpropagating beams, and so the lattice spacing is on order of half the wavelength. But if you image, you typically have a lens outside the vacuum chamber, and so you have a very small numerical aperture, and therefore or the resolution is 10 to 20 times worse than that. What we could do now is we could increase the aperture to a very large value, for example, like you do it in normal microscopy. That's one additional problem then. You can imagine the depth of focus becomes very small. If you have a large aperture that you have a spatial resolution on order half micron, then the depth of focus is also only on order half micron. And so if you have a 3D cloud like this, you would you still could not image single plane, because all the other atoms would perturb you, essentially. So our idea is to make a two-dimensional optical surface trap, like it is shown here, where you have a 2D system now, and then this is done in a way that we also have a very large aperture here that we can use for imaging. And let me see, do I actually have the system that we are currently building has an optical surface here, and this is like a hemisphere, and then our aperture that we have for imaging here is an A of 0.8. Which means that the optical resolution is in principle the theoretical resolution if you have counterpropagating waves divided by 0.8. So it's really very close to the theoretical limit. And here's a sketch of that, just a fancy picture. And the idea is that we can then use that not only for imaging atoms, but also for creating arbitrary potential landscapes and manipulating the ultra-cold gases. How we would do that in the beginning is we would we want to start with the Bose-Einstein condensate, and then we would create evanescent waves at the optical surface. For example, if we shine the laser beam inside this glass like this and have a total internal reflection, then we would get an evanescent light wave that falls off exponentially at the surface. Like here is glass and here is vacuum, and we get this light potential that would fall off exponentially here. And this is reminiscent to the work of Rudi Grimm, who has worked on concepts like that for, I guess, about 10 years now, where they made Bose-Einstein condensate in a gravito-optical surface trap. But in their case, it is a much more complex procedure, where they also start laser cooling the atoms in such a trap, and then they have a multi-step process to get into a 2D regime. In our case, we would make a Bose-Einstein condensate or a degenerate Fermi gas conventionally, and then we would load that into a 2D confinement at the surface. Now, how can we get a real 2D confinement? One way is to have two evanescent waves, one blue and a red one. But recently, we actually favor a different scheme where we actually reflect a laser beam off the surface, and so we essentially get a standing wave here, and we can then control. We can then load one single pancake in the standing wave in a very clean and efficient way with this optical surface. But we only have the evanescent wave in the beginning, and we have all the atoms in one pancake of the standing wave essentially.
So you have the evanescent wave plus the lattice.
We would start with an evanescent wave, for example, and then we could load it into just the lattice, for example, which is formed by only one laser beam that is just reflected off the surface.
And then you don't need that.
So it's a fairly simple approach. Excuse me?
And then you don't need the evanescent
wave. And then I could even switch off the evanescent wave, because there are some problems with some technical problems if you have light scattering. If you have tiny surface impurities on the surface, then you get scattered light that interferes. So you get corrugation of potential if you use evanescent waves. But if you don't do that, if you in the final step then only have a standing wave, then you totally get rid of those problems essentially.
So the confinement in Z direction is actually in microns. It's not.
Excuse me. Yes.
I mean the confinement in Z direction is in microns, right? It's not really.
It's on order of micron. Well, here, this was calculated for two evanescent waves, but now when we use a standing wave in that direction also, then it is just like in any optical lattice experiments, and it can be many kilohertz, between 10 and 100 kilohertz trap frequency, for example, or like the size could be much smaller than a micron.
How do you avoid the van der Waals fluctuations from the glass?
Yeah, so about 2 micron away, the van der Waals forces are fairly small. Like there have been BC experiments, for example, by Vladan Vuletic, where they have measured that as long as they stay away more than about 1 micron, they haven't seen any heating effects and things like that. Now, that is in contrast to experiments in magnetic microtraps. If you have metal at the surface and even current flowing, then you have a lot of Johnson noise, which is intrinsic to the and in that case you would get a very strong interaction and a fluctuating electromagnetic field essentially, which leads to spin flips and other heating processes. But since we have glass here, we only have van der Waals interaction, which just gives us a constant potential, which I've plotted here. And so it gets large once you get very close, about a small fraction of a micron. But at anything larger than a micron, this is very negligible.
But Van der Waals interactions are dynamical. they have a high frequency spectrum going up, not approaching the optical, but going up to high frequencies. And they're continuously delivering those fluctuations, especially to low energy frequencies. That's a very common.
Okay. To my knowledge, as long as you stay away more, it falls off very rapidly, of course, and so it's all a function of how far away you are. And I've looked into some estimates of that, and the outcome was that as long as you stay further away than about a micron, this is much smaller than other effects, essentially. But it's an interesting question. It's probably worth looking into that into more detail. But the nice thing is, if you do this in a standing wave, you could actually really measure this and map that out. And there have been experiments with BEC close to insulators, and that have suggested they have not seen any effects as long as you stay away more than one micron, essentially.
This is all frequency are far from resonance, or it is a resonance?
The light, you mean, from the? It's all off. Yeah, it's all the light fields are far from resonance, right? If you treat them all as a conservative potential.
So, what are the advantages of this scheme over just the usual slicing of the condensates, like a very strong lattice in the third direction?
Yeah, I mean, in the end, we do that. In the end, it's just the loading of one of these slides, essentially, of one of the slices. And the advantage is that we only have one 2D system, and then if you, for example, image, we can be sure that there are no other atoms around. I mean, we'll see how the experiment goes. We could even, as you said, we could even load a 3D system, and then we could ramp it close to the surface and only couple to one of the pancakes, essentially. But this would all be possible. But what is important for us is that we really have a 2D system, because then we can really use the high optical resolution for all kind of experiments. Because it's intrinsic. If you want to have high optical resolution, you have a small depth of focus. That is intrinsic. So therefore, we need a 2D system. Another thing that we could do is we could load two wells, and then we could do, for example, treat one well as a phase reference and see similar to the experiments in Paris. Or okay. And then we can also create other lattice potential. The one idea is that if you have an evanescent wave, if you reflect this back, then you would also get a standing wave. But we're actually currently working on experiments where we use the imaging optics directly to project lattice potentials, and that actually looks fairly promising. It is important to be very careful about stray light and things like that, but it actually turns out it is not that different. Like if you in a normal experiment, you would have a 3D cloud and you would shine two laser beams onto the atoms. It is really not that different if you use an optics and you send the two laser beams in here and here, and then they get projected here and form a standing wave here. It turns out we have done a couple of preliminary tests which show that in that way it seems we can make lattice potentials where the fluctuations are way smaller than 1% or so. So it seems very promising that you can really project arbitrary lattice and lattice potentials in this way. Yeah, this is just a technical thing. This is our objective. It's technically challenging to get these apertures, but we have succeeded in doing so. And in our final experimental system, it turns out we really have this numerical aperture on order 0.8, and we get only a very small wavefront distortion on order of lambda over 8, which means that we can really treat this as an ideal optical system with a numerical aperture of 0.8. Now, what could we do with such a system? The one thing is we could image atoms in optical lattice. If the lattice spacing is large enough, then you could really tell with high fidelity whether there is an atom on a side or not. And the one thing that helps with that kind of measurement is actually that with the high aperture here, we can actually very efficiently collect scattered photons. It actually turns out it's independent what type of imaging you do, whether you do absorption imaging, whether you do phase contrast imaging, whether you do fluorescent imaging. It's all if you're asking for signal to noise, it is all, in the end, the only thing that counts is how many percent of the scattered photons you collect in your optical system. And the nice thing is that with this optical system, we can collect a very large fraction of the scattered photons, about 25%, which helps us a lot to get a very good signal to noise and really detect individual atoms with high fidelity, essentially. We would actually also have to hold the atoms in place in if you want to optically image them with high resolution, we also have to hold them in place, and we would need additional lattice potentials, or we can just use the lattice potential that we also want to create in the 2D system to hold the atoms at a certain location while we image them. And it's important to be reasonably far in the Lamb-Dicke regime there, but it all seems very, very promising, essentially. And right, and you could also do imaging that is independent. In that case, if you use the hyperfine states, and then you would only scatter photons in one of the spin states, for example. But what is besides the imaging, as I mentioned, you can also create arbitrary potential landscapes, for example, by directly projecting lattice potentials or other arbitrary potential landscapes onto the atoms, or also disorder, for example, if you just have a spectral potential, you could create disorder where the length scale of the disorder is also only on the order of the lattice spacing.
Systems are effectively two-dimensional, right?
Yeah, right. And a third thing, and I would like to talk about that a little bit in the last part of the talk, is we can also use the optical excess to manipulate the quantum state. For example, what you can think about is that you can locally create a spin excitation, for example, by flipping the spin on a very small, in a very small area in your 2D system only, or if you have a lattice, by flipping the spin only on one lattice side, and then see how the excitation propagates, or things like that. Or what we want to do is we want to use Raman transitions to create excitations like a vortex anti-vortex pair in a 2D system, and I will talk about that in a few minutes if I have time. Okay.
You have two atoms on distance of actually lambda over 2.
Mm-hmm.
And you want to do, say, a pi rotation of one of them to some other state. How much is the other one affected?
So if it's pi over 2, then the other one is affected still quite a bit. I mean, there are different schemes how you can partially get rid of that by using different modes. Yeah, it is hard to really only affect atoms on one lattice side. I mean, there are some very interesting ideas actually that you can use in microscopy. You can do manipulations much larger than the wavelength. And we're actually currently working on schemes. Michel Lukin is also working on that theoretically, based on ideas of Peter Sala also that we can create a system where you can get much higher resolution for things like that than the optical resolution. I have a few slides on that, but I don't know if we have time to talk about that in the end. But there are our ideas, and we can also discuss them later today or tomorrow. Let me just mention real quick what Peter asked before about inhomogeneous systems. So far, in all the experiments, you have an inhomogeneous system, but typically it is not possible to discriminate or to resolve different regimes in that inhomogeneous system. And now I think that a system with optical resolution would be able to solve such a problem in two ways. First of all, we would be able to create a box-like potential, for example, where you have a pretty much homogeneous system in a certain area, and then you have a steep confinement. So how you could do that is if you imagine you have this 2D system here, you could try to avoid any harmonic confinement here, but then you can shine in a laser beam similar to what Rudi Grimm has done in his experiments already with the surface trap, where you have an exicon beam. An exicon beam is a ring-shaped laser beam, essentially, which has a potential that is only which is essentially a hollow tube of laser light, and you can have a pretty steep rise here. So if you plot the potential along this axis, then you would find a potential that is very steep here, and then is flat, and then goes up again here, for example. And it is round, and so we could make a 2D system which is fenced in essentially in this round fashion with an axicon beam like that. I guess whether it is flat or not, it always depends on the scale you're asking. It might not be possible to get it absolutely flat, but the curvature could be very, very small in typical systems, and so this could be one interesting approach. On the other hand, actually, it turns out that often an inhomogeneous system helps you, actually. For example, if you're asking about temperatures in a mod insulator, for example, or in fermions also, it turns out that in a mod insulator, you can get colder temperatures in the mod insulating region, in the core, for example, if you also have a superfluid around, which then carries a lot of the entropy. And there have been recent calculations pointing that out, essentially, that it can actually really help you to have an inhomogeneous system. And so I think that our system with the optical resolution could really help you to make use, like, to still have an inhomogeneous system, but then to measure that system with a spatial resolution, which would allow you, and if it is a system where the length scale is such that you can still assume a local density approximation in a certain area, then this will give you still a lot of information about the system, and you might not actually need a homogeneous system to get quantitative results. Do an example here. If you have a mod insulator, for example, here you can see the mod lobes. Here's the chemical potential. Here is the tunneling over the interaction.
Is there a typo? Is that from your thesis? Is there a typo in the? Is this n is equal to 3, n is equal to 2, n is equal to 1 in the mod lobe?
Yes.
It's from your thesis, right?
You mean here or here?
No, here. Inside, yeah.
Oh yeah, that's actually right.
From your thesis, I noticed that.
Is it wrong in the thesis?
You just
I never saw that. Thanks, you're the first person. Yes, that's wrong. And that's from the thesis. Interesting. I've never seen that.
The only reason I got confused was I saw a picture a year ago.
No, that's right. So and Levy, to be mind you, if you have an inhomogeneous system in a certain lattice depth of J over U, then in an inhomogeneous system, what you get is a profile here where you have the maximum effective chemical potential in the center of the trap with a mud insulator with 2, and then you have a superfluid shell, and then you have a mud insulator with 1, for example, and another superfluid shell. Now, in our system with high resolution, you could actually image that, and you could, for example, extract the atom number fluctuation from such a
Is that a simulation?
It's not a real experiment yet, but it's actually interesting. I don't have time to talk into that in detail, but maybe we can discuss it later. There are ways to measure these fluctuations even if you cannot count atom numbers with high fidelity. So even if you're not in the regime where you really can they can really resolve individual sites with high fidelity, you can still extract a lot of parameters such as fluctuations. And I don't have to talk.
So if things go right, you anticipate seeing pictures like that, actual experimental pictures like that?
Yeah, I expect to see experimental pictures like this. This is a simulation of an experiment that I'm planning to do, essentially.
When exactly, what is the system? What kind of signal is that?
You could do two things. You can either just count your atoms on the lattice side, essentially, and then extract that. But it turns out what you can also do is you can look for Dirac scattering, actually. And it turns out that if you have a mod insulator and you have an exactly known number of particles on each side, then the Rayleigh scattering would vanish. That's like, if you ask the question why the sky is blue, that's because you have fluctuations in the density. And that is essentially the same here. If you have coherent scattering, then the scattering is Rayleigh scattering. If you have a mod insulator, you wouldn't scatter any light. If you have a superfluid, you have fluctuations in atom number, and you would see this light. And it turns out that the amount of light you measure is directly proportional to the variance of the number statistics. And so the idea is, if you do something like this, you could directly then measure and extract from these profiles the variance of the atom number versus the chemical potential, essentially, and map that out. And this, of course, is also very interesting for fermions, where things like that are interesting. Or if you use a spin-dependent probe, then this kind of, it could tell you about spin excitations and things like that.
Can I use it for thermometry also?
I think that might actually be very interesting for fermion. Yeah, sure. I mean, here it's very clear. If this would actually be very sensitive to thermometry, that's right. Because if you have a lot of particle hole excitations in your mod insulator, or if these are fermions in your fermacy, you would measure them on top of a zero background here. Like, if you see light, these are like all the light you see comes from particle hole excitations, essentially. And so this should be a very sensitive measure of particle hole excitations. Exactly. Yeah, these are new ideas that we have, and about the first experiments, we want to try them with a new system, essentially. But again, the idea is, since we can now resolve it optically, even if we can't get quite to really telling with very high fidelity whether we have an atom on a single side or not, we can use this resolution to measure properties like the variance in the atom number directly, which could be interesting for temperature or for just as a probe. But then also we can use an inhomogeneous system, and in a single picture we can do an entire measurement, essentially, of the of a certain parameter, such as the variance versus the chemical potential in a single shot, essentially, which would allow for very efficient quantum simulation.
We won't be able to do that on a single sample.
This would be a single sample. Single sample.
I see. So you simultaneously are accessing every pixel with the same bandwidth. Is
Right? Yeah, we shine light onto the atoms,
yeah,
and coherently scatter that light, let's say.
Sort of a similar question. What is the frequency range of the fluctuation that you're talking about?
Yeah,
that is.
Yeah, that is given by your optical. That's indeed given by optical resolution, because that's the cutoff. If you have fluctuations on a very short length scale, then that gives you scattered light in a cone with that has a large angular distribution. In terms of time, okay. In terms of time, this is a snapshot. We would freeze everything. We would freeze the tunneling, and then do the scattering experiment. In terms of time, this is, or at least the way I thought about it. I don't know that it might be possible to do time experiments, but I mean, this imaging is not. You would perturb the system with that, obviously, because you measure the atom numbers essentially. But and the spatial length scale of the fluctuation is given by your resolution of the imaging system.
Yeah, but the superfluid has the number of fluctuations only because the particles are hopping from one side.
Okay, that's right. That's right. Imagine a system you have a lattice that where atoms still tunnel, and just before we do the imaging, we freeze the atom number statistics by switching off the tunneling. Then we still have the fluctuations. It's like in the collapse and revival experiment we did a couple years ago, where you start with a superfluid state, where you have a coherent state on every lattice side, but then you switch off the tunneling, and so you just project this into the MOT regime. You just freeze the atom number statistics, and now you could measure it. And if you measure it, then you get a random atom number everywhere with Poissonian statistics. But this measurement is destructive enough that we really project on each lattice side, we will project to a random number state, essentially. And those fluctuations we could then see.
This is like a two-dimensional, strictly two-dimensional image, but actually it's still a third-dimensional.
Not necessarily. No, we really want to make a 2D system. However, you could actually make this in a 3D system as well.
This is like in a real 2D, finite temperature, you don't really see this.
You won't get a superfluid in the sense of that you get an infinite coherence length, essentially.
But
in a finite system, you still have something that you can call a superfluid.
In the third dimension,
you have
some point in the
model
trench over there.
Because we would get this physics for a 2D system. No, but it's flat in one dimension. It's only lattice sides in one plane. But you could even make a 3D system and it wouldn't hurt you. It would actually increase your signal to noise. It's right. You would just average. Yeah, but it doesn't matter, because if they are far enough apart, they would not. They are uncorrelated, so the light from the different planes wouldn't interfere with each other, and you just doesn't matter. You just get more signal.
Take a lot of fluctuating things and superimpose and leverage.
It would work. If you have a lot of layers like this, you have light coming from this layer, light from the next, but this is uncorrelated with respect to each other here, and so it would still work in a 3D system. But it might be easy in a 2D system, actually. It's cleaner. Okay. What is the time, actually?
You're welcome to continue.
Okay.
Those who want to leave will leave.
Good. Okay, great. Then let me just tell you a bit more about one application where we want to use the high optical resolution to do to manipulate the beam with Raman transitions. As you all know, there have been very interesting experiments with vortices. For example, here you can see a picture of a BC that rotates and that has formed a vortex lattice here. But normally these vortices are created in a way that you rotate that and then they spontaneously form and the Gibbon said would be a system where they arrange in such an in such a vortex lattice essentially. What would be the most interesting regimes with the vortex physics is a regime where the number of vortices gets comparable to the number of atoms, because then you get into the quantum Hall regime essentially, or what happens is that the individual vortices melt at first and would overlap and you can't really distinguish them anymore, and later you get into into things like quantum Hall regime and so on. Now, one idea that we had is that we could use Raman transitions. If you have this 2D, if you have a 2D system with optical access, then you could also do Raman transitions, where the Raman laser beams actually have a certain phase pattern, let's say, in that plane. And the nice thing is that with the Raman transition, you can copy the phase pattern from a light beam onto Bose-Einstein condensate, for example, or onto fermions and so on. And recently, there also has been an experiment already a couple of weeks ago at NIST in the group of Bill Phillips, where they have used one beam with an angular momentum and another beam, and then they have created essentially a phase in the condensate that spirals with 2 pi around that optical vortex. But in that case, it was a very big vortex. Now, the idea is that with this high resolution, we could do experiments like that with on a much smaller length scale, and we could create, for example, we could do experiments. Imagine that you have a 2D gas, and now we can create a vortex anti-vortex pair at a given location and a given time, and then we could observe that pair and see what happens and how they would develop in time. It seems very interesting to me to study this time of physics in a way where you not only wait for spontaneously formed vortices like in experiments in Berkeley or Paris, but instead really you can really create a certain excitation at your will, and then you can see how the system reacts to that. So how we want to do that is we actually we need to create optical beams that have a certain phase pattern or that have vortices, for example. And how we can do this is with holograms, actually. And while we built the BSC experiment, I had one student work on that to make holograms with beams of angular momentum. Here, the basic idea is that you have a stripe pattern mostly, and you use the first diffraction order. But on one side of the hologram, you would have one stripe less than on the other side, and you can see already if you get the diffraction pattern, then if you go around this bifurcation, you would have a total phase of 2 pi here, and you would create a laser beam with angular momentum around that point. Here you can see an experimental picture where we have made such a laser beam, which is pretty constant and homogeneous here, and we have one spot in the middle which is dark, essentially, which is our vortex, and we also can put this hologram into an interferometer, and then we see that on one side we get constructive interference with a reference beam, on the other side we get destructive interference, which really tells us that we have that our phase evolves by 2 pi if you go around here in the optical beam. So this is fairly technical now, but I just want to show you that we can create these things at will. And the idea is that we can then use our high resolution optics to project that onto an atom, onto our 2D quantum gas.
Of course, I have a question. Mm-hmm. Well, how dark is this dark spot? Is it like, it's not exactly zero, right?
Yeah.
What's the ratio between bright and dark?
It depends on how careful you are. If you had a scalar light field, or if light was a scalar field, it would be perfectly zero, right? But it's not. You have polarization. So we work in one polarization basis, and we have one polarizer before the hologram and one after that. So as long as we work with small angles and so on, and take care about polarizations, it is still very close to zero.
So it's basically determined by how well can we balance two polarizers.
Right. It's determined by that mostly. It's a bit more complicated if you now have a system where you have a very high aperture. Like, let's say we now put this beam into our optics with high optical resolution. Well, at that point, you would have to be careful what you do with. It would really be nice if light was a scalar field. But it's just, I mean, depends what you want to do. Sometimes the polarization is a powerful tool. But for some things, it would be very nice. Because what happens is that you have to be very careful how this light interferes. If you have a large aperture optics, like the small aperture optics, the beam always come from pretty much the same direction, and so you can just separate it in horizontal basis and vertical, or sigma plus, sigma minus. If you now have high resolution optics, we have our beams come in with about 45 degrees from the normal, which means that in the worst case, if you have a polarization like this, they wouldn't interfere at all. Or if the and so what we would try to do is polarization like this, that would always interfere. But you would really have to calculate how this looks like in the focus, depending on your polarization. And what can happen in particular is you always, in every polarization basis, you have a vortex or a vortex line. But it's not clear to me, they don't necessarily have to be in the same spot. So therefore, instead of having a dark line, you in every basis you choose, you have a dark line. But it could be at a different position, a different basis, and so you get a complicated polarization pattern.
Mm-hmm. Just to come back to your basic proposal here. Suppose you've got two vortices of charge, plus and minus one, mm-hmm. in your field of view. Mm-hmm. So they're going to be moving at something like a kilohertz, because your circulation quantum is at the range of 10 to the minus.
Mm-hmm.
So do you have enough signal to noise to see two objects moving at a kilohertz?
You mean to image that then?
Yeah.
I think that we could.
Even just having a movie camera to do that.
Yeah. So what we could do is, I think what would be very powerful for these experiments is if you have a phase reference. Because then you can do exactly what we do here with light. We could take an image like this. If, for example, we use an internal state of the atom, we can do an image like this. We take a picture like this. We can immediately tell, okay, this is a vortex with that charge. So again, this is light. This is not atoms. But with atoms, you would see the same if you use this light wave that we create here with this hologram in a Raman transition, the slide there later, to create a system with certain angular momentum and vortices and so on and so on. If you then do a measurement with some kind of phase reference, which could just be a different spin state, then we would see a picture like here, and we could clearly tell that we have a vortex here, even though, like, essentially, like here you can see, if you just look for a dark spot, this might get hard if you have a bad signal to noise. But something like this, you would always see, and here this would correspond to a multiply charged vortex, for example. So I think you could see individual vortices even in a very dilute regime.
Sure. No, I was asking if you could see them moving. I guess your answer is no. You want to see. You just want to take a snapshot and see.
Do I take a snapshot? And yeah, okay. But you see the phase gradient in a way. I mean,
why not? If high collection efficiency, let's say the rate of photon scattering is like, you know, whatever.
I mean, what do you mean by see the moving? What do you mean? Like see one single atom moving around, or?
Suppose you have two vortex cores.
Yeah.
They move in the same.
Oh, the two cores around each other. Yeah. No. Sure. You could resolve that. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I didn't understand what you meant.
I think it's easy.
Yes. Sure. Yeah. 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 You could see if you create a vortex and a vortex pair, you could see how they behave. Yeah.
Here the vortex you show is the vortex of the optical field, not the vortex of the condenser.
Excuse me?
But the vortex can be shown here.
Mm-hmm.
It's the vortex of the optical, it's a light field, not the vortex of the Poisson instant condenser.
Yeah, so here it's a light field so far. Okay. That's what we've done so far. But then
only fail from the laser from the intensity, not from the phase of the laser.
No, no. In a round, okay. So what we want to do.
What is
let me go.
From the light.
So let me show. The idea is that we do a Raman transition from between two hyperfine states, for example. So we go, we take one laser beam to go up to a virtual level here that is detuned with respect to the real and levels, and take a second laser beam that goes down again. The trick is now that one of these laser beams is the beam that has the angular momentum. The other one is a beam in the same direction which does not have any angular momentum. And if you then calculate this process, you find that in the end, the matter wave function just, you just copy the optical phase. I mean, the phase of the final state is given by the phase difference of these two beams. But this phase difference of these two beams now spatially varies. And so you can really map a phase of a light wave onto a phase of a hologram with a Raman transition.
No, I have another question, bro.
A phase of a BC.
That you transfer the angular momentum from the photon fields to the matter field.
Yeah.
It seems that if you keep shining the laser, you are transferring more and more angular momentum into the Poisson instant condenser. You mean the system?
No, you would do a Rabi oscillation. What you do is, okay, what in a Raman process, what happens is that the atom, for example, takes out one photon out of the light beam that has the angular momentum, and emits one photon into the beam that has no angular momentum.
Yes.
So therefore, now it has changed its internal state, for example, and it's rotating. Now, if you shine the beam longer, then it would emit. The next step would be that it would go back again. It would do a Rabi oscillation. So now it would again. Now it would take a beam out of the light with no angular momentum and emit one photon into the light beam with angular momentum. And so it would just go back and forth, for example.
So the other limitations on the tolling of
well, this is exactly given by your optical resolution. Because if you want to make a light beam that has a lot of angular momentum, you need a lot of k vectors coming from different sides. Right, and that is limited by your aperture, essentially, and that's exactly what got me interested into that. Because in our system with high aperture, we could make something like that with high angular momentum.
But the maximum value in your system is that? So the maximum angle in the sense of this question. So for your setup.
What unit do you want? The question is, it turns out, okay, you cannot make, for example, if you have a vortex, okay, it's kind of determined by the size of your optical vortex. The size of your optical vortex is determined by the aperture. If you have a multiply charged vortex, then the size is for the same aperture, the size is larger. Now, how should I say that? The question is, what are you thinking about? Are you thinking about one vortex that is multiply charged, or are you thinking about...
He thinks about a single one which is multiply charged, but
okay.
The maximum angular momentum. That's the question.
Okay. I would have to think about what is the highest number of quanta you could get. Fundamentally, it is limited. If you have a big optical vortex here, and then you want a phase gradient around here where each of these lines are 2 pi phase step, fundamentally it is limited by this being half the wavelength of your light. If you have an aperture, if you have NA of 1, then you can send in plays a light from these directions and these directions, essentially, plus the other way around, and you get a phase gradient that winds like this. Now, you can make any arbitrary angular momentum, but the more quanta of angular momenta you have, the bigger this vortex has to be. So you have no light in all the center, and then at some point you can, at some point your vortex gets big enough that the radius here is large enough that it can support this wave. But I mean, technically what we have done is up to, I think, what's this, eight vortices here, but it's really not a limitation. I mean, technically we could make larger, but keep in mind your vortex gets bigger then. And so we could do two things. We could make holograms with multiply charged vortices. We can also make holograms with vortex pattern, for example. Like this would be the hologram, and now you have a lot of vortices here in a pattern. And then in the you can see how that looks like in an interferometer, essentially. And the idea is now that with our optics, we could project this onto the atoms, and the spacing of these vortex could be on the order of a micron, for example. So we could create angular momentum or an array of vortices, or also only just two vortices, for example, that are spaced by only one micron, let's say. And it seems that that is also on the order of the density of the system, and so I haven't seen theory on that. That would be very interesting, but it seems to me that we can get into interesting the regimes there where the vortex spacing is on order of the interparticle spacing, essentially. Also on order half a micron. That's again given by your imaging system.
So I suppose this method can also apply to optical lattices to generate vortices.
Yeah. Yeah. You could do that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The other question. Presumably, if you create this array of vortices in some relatively quick time, then you've added angular momentum to the system, but you've also added energy. That is, you won't it'll be hot.
Your phonons.
Yeah. Yeah. So you're not going into an ion state. So now you have again, a cooling problem. The question is it, I don't know anything, so is it easier to cool? So you have to pull without losing the angular momentum.
Yeah.
Is that an issue? Or?
I mean, probably not. It depends. I'm not even saying we want to compete with experiments that stir a system and then try to be extremely uniform so that you really get a ground state and so on. I think it will be hard. This method will be hard. It will be hard to use this method to really compete with that and to really be in an equilibrium state and so on. I mean, who knows? It might just be an efficient way to just spin it up once and then you can cool. But I'm not sure. I don't know. It might be possible, but I was more thinking about just doing dynamics experiments, like not t equals zero, just creating a very known excitation and see how the system responds to it. That's more what I was thinking in this case. Right. Yeah, and the current status is that we got a BEC last week, actually, so that that is nice. And we expect to have the 2D trap running in summer, essentially. And we also shine in the light beams with angular momentum. We plan to do that next week, but we don't have a 2D system yet. So far we have a 3D condensate and just want to try to have a multiply charged vortex and things like that. And so it's all good in progress, and I just wanted to give you a very informal overview of kind of what kind of ideas we have, because of course, like all kind of theoretical input is extremely valuable to us in any point at any stage of the experiments. Yeah, I guess I would like to thank my students, actually, and I would thank you a lot for your attention.
You
mentioned about the randomized potential. Did you make something with that?
Which potentials?
Randomized.
Randomized. In a system like that, that is very straightforward. We don't, and there are some experiments now that, okay, the thing is you can make a randomized potential, for example, with just a speckle pattern, and you need a large aperture to do that with small spacing. And recently people have realized that, oh, you don't actually need an optics that is as good as ours, like that really creates, that has a small distortion of the wavefront, because if the wavefront is random anyways, you can just have a very bad optics and still just shine light in from all directions, and that's what people do now. So even with an optics that's not as sophisticated as this, you could create a speckle pattern where the randomness is on order half micron or so. But we could also do this with this system, for example. Okay, thanks a lot.